Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. By the way, be sure to join us on Facebook at facebook.com/unkknowledge. facebook.com/UNC knowledge. By the way, we'll have some extra content from this show with Andrew Roberts on our Facebook page. Andrew Roberts holds a doctorate from Cambridge, is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, and is the author of works such as Masters and Commanders, Napoleon and Wellington, Eminent Churchillians, Salisbury, and A History of the English-Speaking Peoples Since 1900, completing Winston Churchill's work of his History of the English-Speaking Peoples up until 1900. Historian Robert Service called Andrew Roberts' most recent book sparkling. Historian Paul Johnson called it engrossing, and The Economist magazine called it simply magnificent. Today on Uncommon Knowledge, Andrew Roberts and The Storm of War, A New History of the Second World War. Andrew Roberts, thank you for joining us.
Not at all. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Segment one, why the wrong side might have won. You spend a good deal of time in The Storm of War assessing why the Germans in particular, why the Axis, but why the Germans in particular lost, which requires, particularly for this generation, establishing the premise that there were good reasons to suppose they might have won. The ordinary soldier, let me quote The Storm of War, quote, "It is indisputable that the Germans were the best fighting men of the Second World War," close quote. Explain that.
Well, the way in which the Second World War unfolded was not in any way predestined, any more than any other war is. It was a series of successes against Poland in 1939, against France, of course, which collapsed in 6 to 8 weeks in 1940, successes in Scandinavia earlier than that in the April of 1940, and then all the way through in 1941 up to the invasion of Russia. One thinks of Yugoslavia collapsing in 3 weeks. Mm. Any objective, and Britain being flung off the continent from Crete, any normal objective observer at that stage would think that the Nazis were unbeatable. And if they had adopted a different strategy, if they had come down into the Mediterranean, flung Britain off the North African littoral, this of course is long before America comes into the war, which is also something that they could have done with a fraction of the 3 million men that they unleashed in Operation Barbarossa against Russia, then Iran and Iraq, where we had 80% of Britain's oil coming from, would have been closed off. We only had skeleton forces there. And Hitler could then, in his own good time, have attacked Russia from the south and not necessarily just had to have come 1,000 miles across from Poland, which of course is what he did in June 1941. So adopting different strategies could have won him the war.
And what about the sheer technical ability of the Germans as a fighting force? You write that the soldiers, the German soldiers, I can't quite remember the figures, but there's something like it sounds quite brutal, but you're assessing the German war-making machine as a war-making machine, the Wehrmacht, the war-making capacity, that the Germans killed 20 to 30% more Americans and British and a much higher ratio of Russians whenever they encountered them.
That's right.
And
this
they lost.
And this is true whether they had whether they were winning or losing the battle, whether they were had air superiority in pretty much every case. Now, that isn't true in after the Battle of the Bulge. Once the Battle of the Bulge had been won in mid-January 1945, then these ratios were very different. But up until
that's
that
the final, point, what, 6-7 months of the war?
Exactly.
Right.
Up until that point, the German warfighting capacity was superior to anybody else's in the world. But one has to remember, of course, that the Germans knew when the Second World War was going to break out.
Yes,
they had been
yes.
training for it. Their army had been in training for it from the moment that Hitler came to power in 1933, whereas the Allies certainly weren't. Your country only had the 17th largest army in the world in 1939. It was Britain, of course, which continued along with France to appease the Germans, didn't build up in the way that it needed to. Secondly, their equipment was absolutely superb. The German tanks, German the 88 millimeter, their rifles, their submarines, to an extent, were just simply superior. And, of course, their generals, men like Erich von Manstein, Gerd von Rundstedt, Erwin Rommel, Heinz Guderian, these were world-class generals. And had Hitler allowed them their say and listened to what they were saying, then he would have done an awful lot better than he did.
So we've got superb equipment. We've got brilliant generals. We have a war-making tradition. You write in The Storm of War that the Germans were fighting their fifth war of aggression in 75 years, and they were simply better than the Allies. As a war-making machine, this was impressive.
Yes. I think we can make too much of the weaponry because by, of course, the time that the United States came into the war, and certainly when Roosevelt in his January 1942 speech said that America was going to become the arsenal of democracy,
yes,
he definitely followed through on that. By the calendar year 1944, when the Germans and Russians were producing 40,000 warplanes each and Britain produced 28,000 warplanes, the Americans produced no fewer than 98,000 warplanes, almost as much as the rest of the world put together. And they were, especially with the P-51 Mustang, capable of taking on and beating pretty much anything that the Germans could put in the air. So it's important to remember that although we started off behind the Germans in terms of weaponry capacity, mm-hmm, we ended up far ahead of them.
Right. Now, segment two, how Hitler got it wrong. I'd like to go through a couple. I mean, it's very frustrating, of course, because this is several hundred magnificent pages, and we have a few moments in which to try to compress it. You mentioned just a moment ago that right up to Operation Barbarossa, the Germans had encountered nothing but success. And had Hitler stopped there, he'd have commanded the entire center of Europe, the Low Countries, northern France, he'd have had much of Scandinavia. All right. Instead, in June 1941, he decides to invade Russia in what you call his cardinal error of the war. Why did he invade Russia? Why didn't he simply stop and consolidate what he had achieved?
Politics. He constantly, whenever the best interests of the Reich bifurcated from the best interests of the Nazi Party, he always did what was good for the Nazi Party, what was in his ideological, fanatical Nazi mind. And a conservative man like Bismarck, for example, or von Moltke, would not have gone down the route that Hitler did. This was because he was a fanatical, unregenerate Nazi. The reasons he invaded Russia were not to do with the best strategic interest for the Wehrmacht, but instead because he wanted to have a final reckoning, as he put it, with the Bolsheviks. He'd been fighting on street corners against communism since the 1920s in Munich. He wanted to wipe out the Bolsheviks. He wanted also, of course, to wipe out the Jews, over half of whom of Europe's Jews, lived in the USSR in 1941. And thirdly, he wanted Lebensraum. He absolutely believed that this idea of living space for the German people in the East would be won very easily. He thought the whole campaign would be over in 4 or 5 months. He told Goebbels, "We will kick in the door and the whole rotten edifice will come crashing down." And he believed that was because the master race, the Übermensch, the Germans, were just superior fighting men to the Slavic Untermensch, and that as a result he couldn't lose. He didn't take into account factors such as the Russian capacity for building tanks, especially the T-34, or the sheer grit of the Russians in holding on, or the sheer numbers of Russians, or their willingness to take appalling losses and not surrender. 1.1 million people, Russians, died in the siege of Leningrad, but Leningrad did not fall.
Mm. Error number two. This, I quote you, Andrew, from The Storm of War. Hitler should have studiously ignored all provocations from Franklin Roosevelt. Instead, the Führer unnecessarily declared war on the uninvadable United States. Japan attacks Pearl Harbor. 3 days later, four days later, Hitler, who's not involved in this, declares war on the United States.
And doesn't need to. He's not under any treaty obligation to do this. He just completely misunderstood the nature of the United States. None of the senior leaders had actually been to America, apart from Joachim von Ribbentrop, who came here in the 1920s to try unsuccessfully to sell champagne for a few years. And therefore, that made him the great expert. And he said, I quoted in the book, how can a Jewified nation like America ever create an army or fight or become fighter aces? It was all done on race. It comes back to this idea that ideology was central. They believed that because America was run by blacks and Jews, that therefore they couldn't fight. The idea is so monstrous in so many ways. Not least, of course, because Hitler knew perfectly well that Jews are very good fighters. He had got his Iron Cross first class from his adjutant, who was a Jew in the First World War. But it comes back again to this idea that America couldn't actually put any men into the European theatre until, Adolf Hitler said, the year 1970. As it was, of course, by the 9th of November 1942, you were landing a vast force on the northwest African coast and knocked the Axis out of Africa by May 1943.
Error three here. Again, let me quote the storm of war. Rundstedt's defense of Normandy in June 1944 was badly hampered by Hitler indeed. This is one of the striking statements from the book. Indeed, Hitler could hardly have helped the Allies better had he been working for them. So right up to Operation Barbarossa, Hitler seems to get nothing wrong. And from the invasion of Normandy, he might as well have been working for the enemy, his enemy.
Yes, and that's what Churchill said as well. At the time of the bomb plot of the 20th of July 1944, when the generals attempted unsuccessfully to blow up Hitler, Churchill said in the House of Commons that he was pleased that the bomb plot had failed because Hitler was such a bad strategist that he was actually helping the Allies. And it was true. He made every mistake in the book. He wound up believing very quickly what Goebbels had been saying about him up until 1941, which was that he was the greatest warlord of all time, and he drank the Kool-Aid, as you say in America.
Segment three. This brings us to the Führer. In the storm of war, Andrew, you write, it is impossible to divorce Axis strategy from the centrality of Adolf Hitler. Of the 650 major legislative orders issued during the war, all but 72 were decrees or orders issued in his name or over his signature. Now, here's the problem. More than half a century after the war has ended, how do you make Hitler intelligible to the 20-year-old student at Stanford University, where we're shooting this now, who looks back and sees a monster, the man responsible for the Holocaust, a strategic incompetent, something like a madman, and yet here he is, central to this massive effort on the part of one of the most important and civilized nations in the very heart of Europe. How do you make that comprehensible?
Well, you're quite right. It's not easy. I think we have quite enough evil in the world today. One thinks of, fortunately, Osama bin Laden's no longer in the world today, but one thinks of him. One thinks also of Saddam Hussein and others who who are evil, and therefore people can understand the concept of a human leader of a country or an organization, a movement, being fundamentally, utterly evil. But the difficult thing is to understand a European country, a country of culture, a country of Beethoven and of Goethe, being taken over by a monster such as Hitler. And then, of course, for him to go off, he spent over half of the war in the Wolfschanze, his headquarters in East Prussia. And he was 1,500 miles behind the lines, and he would meet German generals who would fly out to him, and he would listen to them. We have every word that he said from January 1942 onwards at his Führer conferences. Stenographers would take down every word that everybody said. And so we know that he listened for up to an hour to various generals who are far better strategists than he, men like Guderian and Rommel and Rundstedt and so, and Manstein. And yet, at the end of the meeting, he would go back and do precisely what he'd originally intended to.
All right. On August 2nd, 1934, Hindenburg dies. and Hitler assumes command of the armed forces. You write in The Storm of War, quote, with the complete support of the army. 2 weeks later, a vote takes place on whether Hitler should serve both as chancellor, head of government, and president, head of state, and commander of the armed forces. Quoting you once again, more than 38 million Germans, or 89.9%, voted yes. Make that moment comprehensible to us.
Well, with regard to the army, it was pretty straightforward. There had been, with the brown shirts, the SA, an internal coup on the night of the Long Knives in July 1934, where Hitler, they had wanted to take over the army, to actually be in control of the German army. And the German army did a straightforward deal with Hitler, that if Hitler dealt with the black shirts, then he would be able to demand an oath of allegiance, to have the swastika as the Wehrmacht symbol, and all the various other things that he needed as commander-in-chief to establish control over the army. And so as a result, Hitler did his side of the deal. He killed the senior leadership of the SA in one night, the night of the Long Knives, and so he got everything he needed. Much more difficult, of course, to explain is the 89% vote in favour. But, you know, in 1923, Hitler only had 2.3% of the popular vote. He was a joke leader of a joke political party. By the time of the Great Depression, he was getting 30% of the vote. It really did require this appalling global recession, depression indeed, to fling him into power, because he used scapegoats and he used demagoguery and he used a anti-capitalist message, which went down very well with people who had been broken and forced into unemployment and penury. And without that, there's no way he'd have got an 89% vote.
All right. You also write about Chamberlain. He returns from meeting with Hitler at Berchtesgaden in 1938, and he writes, I'd never come across this before, he writes to his sister, and you quote it in The Storm of War, in spite of the hardness and ruthlessness I thought I saw in his face, he sees it. I got the impression that here was a man, Hitler, who could be relied upon when he had given his word. Close quote. Explain that.
Well,
and of course, it's not just Chamberlain. Lots of people were taken
lots
in.
Of people,
lots of people.
Lots of people. Well, exactly. And well, these people hadn't actually, many of them Victorians, you know, grew up in the Victorian age, were dealing with other members of the House of Commons in British politics. They basically hadn't come across a gangster at all.
They thought he was a gentleman.
They thought he was a gentleman. They hadn't, or at least even they didn't think he was a gentleman. They thought he was someone with whom they could do business. And they were very bad at looking into the soul of the beast. Winston Churchill, on the other hand, who also was a Victorian, but had led a much more wide and varied life than Neville Chamberlain, had seen evil face to face and recognised it very early on.
And where had he seen evil?
Oh, throughout the empire. You know, he'd seen friends of his chopped pieces by Muslim fundamentalist terrorists, effectively, on the northwest frontier. He'd fought in the Boer War. He'd escaped from a prisoner of war camp. He'd taken part in the last cavalry charge of the British Empire. He'd fought in the. He'd been a war reporter in the Spanish-American War. I mean, this man fully understood the nature of and horror of evil up close, and in a way that somebody like Neville Chamberlain, who had rarely strayed outside the confines of Westminster, simply couldn't understand.
Segment four, the Allies. Britain. We're used to hearing these days that Churchill saved Western civilization. Your assessment is a little colder and a little more delimited. Quote, Britain forced Germany into a two-front war. And that's about where you ended at some level, for all the magnificent rhetoric.
We also, I think I also point out that we bought vital year of time between the the fall of France in June 1940 and Hitler's invasion of Russia in June 1941, that 12-month period, we were the British Empire was the only force in the world that was opposed to Hitler, was at war with Hitler. And of course, the Soviet Union was actually allied to Germany at the time. And so whilst the Russians produced oceans of blood.
Yes,
and you produced the most amazing amount of material. And obviously, you fought the Japanese. You landed in Africa, Italy, France, and the rest. What we did produce was the time, which was vital in 1940 because it allowed the rest of the civilized world to rearm.
And how close was Britain to collapse in 1940?
Well, if the British Expeditionary Force had been captured, we might well have been forced into some kind of ignoble peace in the same way that happened to France when its army was captured in that in the May and June of 1940. But fortunately, we firstly, of course, had Winston Churchill's leadership and his sublime oratory.
And he truly is utterly indispensable. There's no one else on the scene who would have done what he did. Is that correct?
No one at all.
Right.
No. I mean, people you won't have heard of, like George Lloyd, a very obscure cabinet minister, who says that he wanted to do the same thing as Winston Churchill, but he simply didn't have Churchill's persona, background, and vitally, this concept of Churchill having for years said, this is going to happen.
Right.
If you continue to appease Germany, this will happen, and then being proved right, which is a wonderful thing in a politician.
The United States, I quote the Storm of War, the American contribution was not primarily in blood, but in the production and distribution of armaments and the overall financing of the conflict, materiel and money. Now, can you add a little something to that to make me feel a little bit better?
Well, you don't want to win a war, you don't want to make to spill oceans of blood. 600,000 Americans died. It's a significant contribution, but compared to the 27 million Russians, for example, of course it's a drop in the ocean. The key thing is, though, you also were vital in the combined bomber offensive, which stopped German military, the increase in military production in its tracks. You were vital, of course, in the whole of the Pacific War, which had to be fought after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and in so many other areas of the war at sea, for example, and then landing the forces at D-Day. You know, that was an astonishing achievement. On the day of D-Day itself, when the Luftwaffe flew 319 sorties over Normandy, the Allies, primarily, of course, the US AAF, flew 13,688.
That is staggering. It
completely
is just staggering.
Got total air superiority by that period.
Right.
And then you landed, and the armies of Patton and Bradley and so on did, win tremendous victories in the West.
The Soviet Union, once again, Andrew, the Storm of War, quote, it was the Russians who provided the oceans of blood necessary to defeat Germany, and it cannot be reiterated enough that out of every five Germans killed in combat, that is, on the battlefield, four died on the Eastern Front. It is the central statistic of the Second World War. Britain kept the Germans fighting in the West. The United States provided money and materiel, but the Soviets broke the Nazis.
Fair? Yes, they did, of course. And what we in the West did, the Western Allies, Canada, America, Britain, and so on, was to kill the fifth German. But the other four were killed in these massive battles on the Eastern Front. When one thinks the invasion of Normandy, a massive invasion, nonetheless, in almost exactly the same time, in July of 1944, on the Eastern Front, when Operation Bagration crushed the Army Group Centre, the Germans' Army Group Centre, no fewer than 513,000 Germans were killed or wounded. Over 500,000 Germans. And this is of a size, and that's just one battle alone. You can think of Kursk, you can think of what happened at Stalingrad and Leningrad and Moscow and finally Berlin. These were the battles that broke the Germans.
Now, let's stay with the Soviets for a bit, partly because this is what, in this country, this 27 million dead in the Soviet Union tends to get overlooked, at least in my generation.
Well, it was because of the Cold War, you see.
Yes.
It wasn't in anyone's political interest in the West to make much of this.
So, again, the Storm of War, quote, the full cost to the Russians amounted to the truly obscene figure of around 27 million dead. But much of the responsibility for the catastrophe lay with Stalin himself. If he had not signed the Nazi-Soviet Pact, if he had not trusted Hitler so totally, if he had not wiped out so much of the Red Army officer corps in the purges, if he'd not gone to war with Finland, if he'd not sent his troops so far forward after his hyena-like pounce on eastern Poland, if he'd not refused to allow strategic withdrawals after Barbarossa, and on it goes. This is a very crude way of getting at it. But of those 27 million Soviet dead, how many, as I say, this is crude, but you'll get the idea, you'll get what I'm trying to get at. How many died because of the Nazis, and how many died because of Joseph Stalin?
Gosh,
that's do you know what I'm trying to get at?
I see what you're getting at, yes. And it's a fascinating question, and of course one that is completely unanswerable.
Oh, yes.
Because it's simply, and he, of course, shot very large numbers of his own men. During the Battle of Stalingrad alone, he killed the equivalent of two divisions. Anybody who tried to run, anybody who didn't obey orders immediately, was shot. The NKVD, the predecessors for the KGB, had entire battalions just shooting deserters willy-nilly, and vast numbers of them, thousands.
Okay, so let's address it. I just want to stick with the Soviets. You've already raised the point about the Cold War, but this massive Soviet loss and the knowledge that they were the ones who broke the German Wehrmacht is often used to justify the occupation of Eastern Europe and those, what of course it became, a 45-year occupation. Do you buy that?
No, not for a moment. As I mentioned, and as you quoted, Stalin made every mistake in the book. He made almost as many blunders as Hitler. He was the only person. He only ever trusted one man in his entire life,
yes.
Stalin, and it was Adolf Hitler.
And why is that?
Because,
this is another...
Well, exactly.
They seem to understand each other.
They seem to understand each other, but... they never met, of course, but nonetheless, the Nazi-Soviet Pact was a disaster, ultimately, for Russia. And yet he went into it in the hope that the Germans would therefore attack in the West. He believed, like many other generals, also believed that there would be a trench warfare in the same way as there was in 1914 to 18. Mm. So he thought he was being brilliant in lulling the Germans off into the other side of the continent.
And was there was an ideological component in Stalin's thinking as well, was there not, that the capitalists would bleed each other?
Yes, exactly. I mean, this goes back to Leninist thought and the assumption that that would happen. However, he was given on no fewer than 80 occasions the warning that in fact Barbarossa was going to take place, including from some of his own spies, giving him the actual day that it was going to happen. Mm. And he ignored all of them. He put it down to English provocation, as he put it. He believed it was Winston Churchill's plot to try and draw Russia into the war. Mm. And so as a result, of course, what happened was on the first day of Barbarossa, no fewer than 40% of the Soviet bomber force was destroyed on the ground. It didn't even get a chance to take off. And its commander, Lieutenant General Ivan Kopets, that afternoon shot himself, which, as I point out, in Stalin's Russia was a sensible career move.
Right, right, right. Segment five, what we need to know. The Second World War ended more than half a century ago. Hundreds of volumes have been written about it. Why did you choose to write? By the way, I want you to know I'm happy you did, but I must ask all the same, why did you choose to write The Storm of War?
Well, I was very fortunate in that I have found new information, important new information in this book. There's a British businessman called Ian Sayer who has an archive of 100,000 letters and papers and documents and photographs and things and books, and vast numbers of unpublished diaries. And in the course of, and he'd never allowed any historians in, so I'm the first historian to be able to use this. And there's an enormous amount that I discovered there, including the real reason why Hitler stopped the panzers above Dunkirk on the 24th of May 1940 and didn't capture Dunkirk, which, of course, if he had, would have meant that the British Expeditionary Force would not have been able to have got away from the beaches. And I found in these papers this letter from Major General Alfred Jodl, Hitler's military operations chief, who explains that that the Führer was expecting that the whole of the BEF and large parts of the French army was going to be captured in the next 3 days. And that completely knocks to pieces the conspiracy theory that Hitler didn't want to capture the BEF and wanted to make peace with Britain and didn't mind that they escaped back to Britain, for example.
Mm. Let me try a little revisionism on you. Patrick Buchanan, wrote a book called Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. Let me quote from Pat Buchanan's book, just to see what you make of it. What made a European war inevitable was not Hitler's occupation of Prague, but Britain's guarantee to Poland. Had there been no war guarantee, there would have been no British declaration of war on September 3rd. There might have been no German invasion of France in May 1940 or ever. There was nothing inevitable about Hitler's war in the West. All right, you've already answered this.
I've debated against Pat in Westminster, in fact, in London.
He is personally irresistible, isn't he?
Most charming man you've ever met.
Yes.
But he talked complete tripe when it comes to the Second World War. And just to give you an idea of this, of the 1,820 people who turned up to my debate against him, something like 1,700 voted for me at the end, and about 180 or so voted for Pat. So let me explain that.
Right.
That it completely fails to take into account the psychology of Adolf Hitler. The idea that he'd have been happy with Poland and would have stopped there does not take into account any of the key reasons why he attacked Russia. His hatred of the Jews, his desire for Lebensraum, his desire to have a final reckoning with the Bolsheviks. Mm-hmm. You know, that would have impelled him on further. He also, of course, the Versailles Treaty and the hatred of everything to do with the Versailles Treaty was an absolutely central part of the Führer principle. And so, of course, he was ultimately going to clean the slates with France. Mm. And also, he had no right to invade Poland. Of course we have the right to guarantee Poland. We didn't actually say that we were going to go to war for Czechoslovakia, which we probably should have done. But it's absolutely fine to say, if you invade a country, then we will go to war with you. And because, you know, the moral and the spiritual responsibility is entirely that of the man who crosses the line, not the person who draws the line.
Well, what do you make of the point? I don't have the book in front of me. It's been a while since I read it. But Pat makes quite a lot of the point that Woodrow Wilson in Paris negotiating the treaty opens a box and out comes this notion of national legitimacy. And so when they carve up Europe, you end up with Germans in Czechoslovakia. The Sudeten Germans were Germans.
Yes.
And Danzig was an almost entirely German city. And so Hitler's acting on
where we went wrong with Versailles was in not splitting up Germany. The reason that we had Germany so peaceful from 1945 and has become a completely pacific country is that it was divided. I mean, Germany in 1815 was 365 states.
And a lovely place it was, too.
And a wonderful place it was, too. Right. From the moment that it actually became one state, once Prussia had established itself in the mid-19th century, it went to war with Denmark, with Austria, with France, and with us twice. So actually, if anything, the Versailles Treaty wasn't hard enough.
Right. Andrew, Europe today, the Berlin Wall is gone, and yet the populations are aging and shrinking. And since 1970 or 75 or so, it depends a little bit on which statistics you're looking at, Europeans seem on average to have chosen vacations rather than a longer period of work, and their productivity is relative to that of the United States and certainly relative to that of Asia, dropping. Unemployment has remained high, chronically high. In France, unemployment among the young has remained at over 10% for a couple of decades now. And now, of course, we have this crisis concerning the euro.
And also large-scale Islamic immigration into Europe as well, on a scale which has never been seen before in European history.
And so is this the Europe for which the Allies fought?
Well, I'm obviously an Englishman and do not consider myself to be a European. And one of the best things that Lady Thatcher did and some of her successors, all of her successors did, was to keep Britain out of the euro, keep sterling separate. And so, you know, it's a tragedy for them, but not, thank God, for Britain. But yes, Europe has got fundamental problems, and the coalescing of Europe into one nation state has not helped, because obviously different countries at different times of their economic development need different interest rates, and you can't have that with a single currency, as we're seeing with Greece and Portugal and others. So it was a mad idea. It might be coming towards its last gasp, but the fact that an idea doesn't work and is a terrible idea doesn't mean that it won't happen. Look at Bolshevism, which for 75 years took a whole wodge of Europe into the wrong direction, into one of history's great cul-de-sacs.
Right.
So
what I guess what I'm getting at is this notion of... Churchill talked about Christian civilization. He talks, that was the phrase he used, that if Hitler were permitted to triumph, it would mean the end of Christian civilization. There were at least a couple of speeches in which he used that phrase. And one just gets the feeling that somehow or other, was it because of the, was it somehow involved in the effort of the Second World War? You get the feeling after the First World War that something, that there's been a smash up of European civilization. I might say, it's hard, where did things go wrong? What would Churchill say if we could somehow revive him? He'd look at across the continent, he'd be appalled, wouldn't he?
German militarism in the run-up to the First World War. There was no need. They were already dominating the continent economically. They had the most successful economy in Europe at the time, including Britain's. And the Kaiser and his advisors did not need to unleash this horrific cataclysm on Western civilization, Christian civilization, as you say. But they had within them this inability to appreciate the true horrors of what war means, which is astonishing considering they'd already started three earlier. So it was ultranationalism, it was militarism, and fortunately it has been something that has been entirely burnt out of the German soul. You don't see it at all today.
Last question. We're shooting today at Stanford, where this year's graduating class will have been born after the end of the Cold War, let alone the Second World War. We want them all to read The Storm of War. Why should they? What is it that remains relevant about that experience to 22-year-olds today?
Well, our whole world has been shaped by the Cold War. The Second World War. Look at the people who are sitting on the Security Council, permanent members. Why should Russia, France, Britain, America and China be there? Well, they were, all of them, the victors of the Second World War. Every time you look around the world, you see constant reminders of the stories and the lessons of the dangers of appeasement, the fact that you do have true evil coming up in the world and which needs to be faced, as well as the fact, of course, that these characters, people like Winston Churchill and FDR and General Brooke and General Patton and Ike and Montgomery, you know, these are giants for any age. And so the story in itself is something that is quite mesmerizing in my view.
Andrew Roberts, author of The Storm of War, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Peter Robinson for Uncommon Knowledge. Thanks for joining us.